Welcome back to The Bookshelf. I'm Ben Reed, and tonight we are continuing The Desk on the Sea, written and read by Jonathan Johnson. In this episode, Christmas and a new year for kite flying.
Scotland. Christmas and a new year begins. On Christmas Eve, dusk comes at 3:30. The shortest day of the year is behind us, but not by much. Amy turns on our little Christmas tree's lights. She and Anya and I walk over to the seawall to see how they'll look from there, shining in our window. The lobstermen have brought in their traps and stacked them in neat rows here and there around the harbor. For the next few days, the boats will stay tied in, and the lobsters will be safe to wander the sea floor. As we walk along the stone seawall quay, Anya challenges Amy and me to a rock jumping race. "You have to jump from big rock to big rock," she explains. "If you step on a crack or a small rock, you have to go back." We take her up on her challenge and race out to the stack of lobster traps on the seawall end, which Anya reaches first. We all look back across the harbor. Amy takes a picture, our white cottage with the tree in the window, little colored lights, the red door. "I wonder if Santa will be coming from the north or south," I say. "If he comes from the south, he'll see this from over the water." "But if he comes from the north, he'll see the sign on the chimney," Anya answers confidently. Earlier in the day, I'd written, "Santa, Anya lives here," in red marker on a sheet of paper, climbed on the roof, and tied the sign to the chimney. "He'll see the sign even if he comes from the south," Amy says. "He'll circle around, looking because of your letter." Anya's letter to Santa, in addition to the usual greetings and asking after the reindeer, informed him of our change of address for the year. Christmas has brought a fresh wave of homesickness for her. Her giddy anticipation has had to compete with little waves of downcast as she misses her old friends, our extended families, and the feet of snowfall in Upper Michigan. Amy's moods and mine have been similarly up and down, and there's been tension between us. When we return from our seawall walk, Anya has a little trouble with the cottage door and shoves on it impatiently. I match her impatience with my own as I tell her to stop and patronizingly instruct her on how to open it properly. Then Amy tells me to stop. "You're turning a fine time into a big negative," she says, with considerable bite in her voice. "Wow, that's an overreaction," I shoot back. And so begins our squabble. Anya sets up London Monopoly in the living room, while in the kitchen her mother and I bicker over which of us overreacted more. Words like unkind and absurd fly back and forth, some of them drifting out to Anya's ears, no doubt. Amy and I both loathing ourselves for that, but still not dialing back. By my count, this is our fifth fight in less than 2 weeks. I feel failure seeping in to swirl and join the poison of anger in my blood. We remain miffed at each other when we sit down on the floor and start marching our little silver tokens, Amy the ship, me the race car, around the board behind Anya's little dog. On the second or third lap, though, somewhere between the Strand and Regent Street, Amy finds her grace and reaches over and pats my leg. "I'm sorry," she says. "I'm sorry, too," I return. "I'm still mad at you, though. And I am a bit, but I'm also trying to be playful, trying to see if we can't patch this up properly in front of Anya. If you want back on my good side, you'll have to kiss me." "Okay." Amy crawls over to me and plants a long, wet kiss on my mouth, to which Anya, of course, exclaims, "Ew!" I find my own grace and apologize sincerely to Anya for my impatience with her at the door. She graciously accepts my apology. I roll the dice, my third double in a row, and land in jail. "That's where you go when you're bad," Amy says. Fair enough. We finish the day by reading 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, as we've done on every one of Anya's Christmas Eves. When we tuck her in, I tell her a bedtime Harry story in which Professor Dumbledore is mistaken for his old friend Santa Claus. Once Anya is asleep and Amy and I have a little time alone, I apologize again. Amy does the same and sighs. "I miss them," she says. I know she means her parents. I know she's thinking about our usual Christmas in their log house outside Marquette. The tree we'd have cut from the forest. the soft blue light of morning over snow on the frozen surface of the little lake out the window. Amy's parents, sister, brother-in-law, and the three of us in pajamas and bathrobes as Anya inspects the tags on the presents and delivers each to its recipient. "I do too," I say. And I know she understands me to mean also my father and sister and mother, whom we used to join later in the morning for more presents, and who, for so many Christmases, came over to Amy's folks for a big dinner. I promise we'll spend Christmas there from now on if we can at all. "If we can, yeah," she agrees. It's been a lonely holiday on the whole. Not only have Amy and I had our quarrels, there's also been a general quiet distance between us. For my part, I suppose all the Christmas imagery and expectations and through the years we all will be togetherness has gotten under my motherless skin. As for Amy, she's got her mother and father and knows the infinite value of every year that's the case. But she's on the far side of the planet from them, with a brooding husband and without her circle of old friends, without snow falling through the pines of her Upper Michigan home. She and I will find each other again. We always do. Meanwhile, I have to remember to be gentle and kind, to be my mother's son. I came to Scotland with a vision of laughter and hand-holding and daily discovery, the luxury of abundant time with my family. I need to keep that vision bright and near my mind's eye and be patient. Amy, Anya, and I headed out the door into a chilly, sunny afternoon. We walked our usual route down the coast path where the waves turned over white and hit the rocks, and the sea wind tossed the grass that seems to hold its green all year. With a grocery sack in hand, Anya led Amy down to the little beach near the old cottage ruins to look for treasures. I watched them a moment, then I hit start on my stopwatch and headed further up the trail on my run. The coast path is at turns challenging and inviting. Rocks protrude from the grass and then rise to jumbles of lichen-marbled boulders. Then the path is grass again, wide and flat a while. Then the path comes to ancient stone fences to cross using friendly stone steps worn smooth by hundreds of years of traveler shoes. Then it climbs steeply, the grass thinning here and there to mud as the trail inclines, where more than once my feet have slid out from under me and I've fallen to smear the side of my knee and hips and hands with mud and even a little blood. But always I've stood and run on, following the winding, undulating, windswept coast. It's an obvious metaphor, that path and my marriage, I know. But as my heart rate rose to a steady, quick pulse, and my feet found a slower beat on the mud and rocks and grass, and the waves fell to an even slower rhythm beside me, I felt completely at home in myself again. And on my return, when I rounded the last point before the ruined cottage and saw Amy and Anya's two red jackets in the distance downshore, I quickened my pace until I reached them. And when I did, I found myself in my vision again. The sunlight slanted through air wet with the faint mist of sea spray. Amy and Anya's sack was full of stones and wood sculpted by waves and time. Bright air moved through their hair and across the colors of Anya's stocking cap and Amy's scarf and their faces, the focal points of all the beauty around them. All there for me. And the only thing I'd had to do to get there was keep going. 2 weeks past the winter solstice, and still evening begins as soon as morning ends. Even with the sun through patchy clouds, the day seems mostly about its own ending. Long shadows, white ranks of waves tinted pink like the tops of clouds. Eager to make what we can of the daylight we have, Amy, Anya, and I take nets and pail and head down to the sea for a little rock pooling. "Look for bubbles, Daddy," Anya says, keeping her eyes on the still water. She nets a shrimp right away. I dip the pail to fill it with water, and she tips her net over and plops in the shrimp, which in its own element again changes back from a stringy, flat piece of seaweed into a swimming creature bristling with delicate appendages. As I trail behind her, bucket in one hand and my own dry net in the other, Anya walks on, holding her net at the ready just above the surface and narrating, "Down here will be good. The rocks are bigger. It's where Emma and I caught a mama and baby crab." "I remember. But you weren't there. I heard about it, though. You let them go. And the mama tucked the baby up under her." At the far end of the pool, as the waves 30 yards out on the rocks loudly send up gold mist behind her, Anya finds two mussels. "We can eat these if you want," I tell her. "Really?" "Sure." "Mama," I call to Amy on the far side of the pool where she crouches taking photos of us. "She found two mussels. Let's have them for dinner tonight." "Sure." "You can eat them?" "I can't wait," I said truthfully. We'll have to buy a few more to go with them at the seafood shop in St. Andrews when we go in for Anya's Highland dance class. But we'll scratch an A into the shells of the two she caught, and we'll steam them all and have them on a dish of garlic and vegetables over pasta that Amy was planning for tonight anyway. "Your first catch for us to eat," I congratulate her. We look for more, but soon Anya says her right big toe is cold. She stands in her coat, gloves, and stocking cap, net in hand, and stares down at her Wellington boots. For a moment, she looks like a much younger version of herself, and I feel a rush of love for her fill me. She's her own separate soul, and I am transfixed by the reality of her. We're alive together, sharing this day. The cold in her big right toe soon spreads to the others. It hurts her to walk, so I carry her on my back while Amy carries the pail and nets as the three of us head for home. As Anya and I sat on the floor, assembling her new ladybug kite, I kept my doubts to myself. In the morning, when the breeze had been merely stiff, I'd talked up the day as great for kite flying. But now I could hear the wind whipping over the chimney and pushing against the windows. And despite our added reinforcements of strong tape, where the hollow plastic shafts met thin plastic sheeting, this seemed to be an especially flimsy kite, something much better suited to bobbing cheerily about in a light breeze. Amy was clearly thinking along the same lines when she came into the living room and we showed her the ladybug wings, spread wide and ready to fly. She said it looked great, but cautioned, "We'll give it a try, but sometimes kites don't last very long, love, and that'll be okay." She might not make it? She might not. Kites are sometimes kind of fragile. Anya looked down at the kite and furrowed her brow. "We'll take the tape and scissors with us," I suggested, "in case we need to make repairs. But Mama's right," I finally confessed. "It's a strong wind out there." Out the window, the tops of the waves were blowing to mist in the afternoon sunshine. "But let's give it a try," Amy said brightly. "Kites were meant to fly, not stay safe inside." "Okay," Anya said, her enthusiasm enough to override her anxiety over the fate of the kite, to which she was already referring with a female pronoun. The winds out on Combo Sands Beach were even stronger than they'd been at the Crail Harbor. They came over the hedgerows and picked up speed across the fields and then poured over the grassy dunes and across the sand and out over the North Sea, hell-bent for Norway. At less than 3 feet across, the kite hardly required both Anya and me to carry it down to the shore from the car, and in fact it would have gotten far less of a violent tossing about if I'd carried it myself against my chest. But this was our project, so we carried it together. Anya on the end of one wing, me on the other, as if the kite were the size of a hang glider. Already we had to make a repair. One shaft had torn a bit loose from the plastic skin. With her gloved hands, Anya needed 3 tries to cut loose a strip of tape that didn't flip about and fold in on itself in the wind. But we made the repair and then added a few more strips for reinforcement. Still, I wasn't giving the kite 5 minutes in the air. It'd be a success even to see it up at the end of the string just once before it was shredded. Anya, however, seemed to have completely forgotten her concern. She was giddy as she unraveled the string and backed away from me while I held the kite and instructed her to run down the beach when I said go, keeping the string taut. "Okay, Daddy," she said brightly, adding to my welling guilt that surely I'd set her up for a bit of a heartbreak. Amy lifted her camera to her eye, ready to catch what would hopefully be a few moments of joy, and, I supposed, thinking to herself what we should do after to salvage the afternoon. Some London Monopoly back at the cottage, maybe. "Okay, go," I said, and trotted along behind Anya as she ran the string taut. I let go, and the kite rose straight into the air. Anya kept running, pumping her legs down the beach while looking up at the kite. "Go, Schmoey!" we cheered. "Well done!" The kite bent her ladybug wings back in the wind and flapped loudly. But she held her place in the air 20 feet above Anya, who, when we called that she should stop running, turned and stood, staring serenely up and giving gentle tugs on the string. A moment later, the kite swooped low over the beach, then swooped again, then went inverted and banged into the beach, where it stayed pinned upside down in the wind. But before I could get there to help, Anya'd given it a few more tugs, and it had righted itself and buoyantly lifted right back up over her. Somehow it seemed to be holding together. And it kept holding together, through more upside-down crashes onto the sand and our running launches, though Anya needed fewer and fewer of these as time went by, and she got better at giving the string just the right tug at the right moment. Soon, she was adept enough to just stand or stroll while the kite held its position at the end of its leash. Finally, she looked down, drew a circle in the sand with her foot, and then sat down. Cross-legged in the center of her circle, in her coat and stocking cap, holding the coil of string in one gloved hand out to her side, the kite obediently keeping to the air above her and the waves tumbling over beyond, she was the very picture of serenity and self-possession. "There is a Buddha in you and a Buddha in me," I recalled my teacher saying when I'd taken some Zen meditation instruction a few years ago. "The Buddha is in all of us." Before long, she was running again, and then spinning fancy turns below the hardly rippling kite, dancing with it. Then she traced another circle with her foot and sat down again in the center while the kite waited in the constant wind. Then Anya reclined flat on the sand, put her free hand behind her head, and stared up at the kite and the clouds above, scooting quickly out to sea. If your own child was a happy one, if your parents were kind and attentive and loving, and there were afternoons of pure joy, it's hard not to think of your childhood as the childhood, the real childhood, the real afternoons of pure joy with the real parents. The challenge, if your own childhood left you with a paradise of memories to which you return as often as you can, but now you've somehow become the parent, is to realize that this, today, is the childhood. The very definition of childhood forever for this new little being. It's bewildering, and at times the realization arrives with a nearly overwhelming sense of responsibility. At other times, though, the realization that now, this day, can be the paradise to which your child returns for a lifetime, and that you are the parent in that paradise, comes with the greatest sense of privilege imaginable. We got maybe an hour with the ladybug kite before her plastic keel began to tear loose and she fell to the sand. "No problem," I said truthfully. "We'll get her taped up at home. This is fixable. But we should get her and us in out of this weather." Rain had come suddenly overland to splatter in the sand and fall on the waves and move with the wind farther out to sea. "It's fixable?" Anya studied the tear. "No problem." "Anya, that was brilliant," Amy said. "You're so good at that. I can't believe we haven't done this since you were little." It had been years, since she was just 4 or maybe 5. Far too long. "It was kind of like my first time. Before, you guys got the kite up and I just held the string," she conjured, from some combination of recollection and imagination. "We'll do this more now," Amy said. "Can we?" "Absolutely," Amy pledged. "This is one of the things I daydreamed about when I was pregnant with you." It's a fine thing to be suddenly filled with desire for your wife. Wind in her hair, rain pelting her puffy coat and soaking into her blue jeans. Sometimes it comes along so suddenly and forcefully, I can hardly believe I'm standing there looking at her. "What else did you daydream about?" Anya asked Amy as we walk back down the beach toward the car. Lots of things, and it keeps changing as you get older. But when you were pregnant, Anya pressed, clearly intrigued by this notion of daydreams in which she'd starred, still unnamed and in utero, her gender unknown to us. Washing you in the sink with help from your Nana, I offered. I remember you said that. I did, Amy said. And reading to you, and singing to you, and flying a kite with you, just like today. Your dream came true, Anya said, as much statement as question. It did. Back in our car pigeon, we warmed up with the heater on while I changed into my running coat. Amy asked if I was sure I wanted to run home as rain smacked the roof and windows. I'll be fine. I like to run in weather. But Daddy, Anya chimed in from the back seat, everything it does outside is weather. That's true. So you like to run in everything? Well, not lightning. I try not to run in lightning. So you don't like to run in weather, just some weather. Anya leaned over and spoke softly. We're in the literal phase, I'd say. I concurred. Right, sweetie, I answered Anya. Very good. Weather like wind and rain. Those I like. Though looking out, I had to admit, if only to myself, a nice dry drive back to the cottage had its appeal. But out I went, and away they drove with smiles and waves. 5 miles of coast later, and one more to go, the sky cleared again. The backsides of the rain clouds that had moved offshore shone pink over the sea as the sun set from around the bend at Fife Ness, the most easterly point on this stretch of coast. Another thing about a happy childhood. It can teach you to continue building a paradise of memories for yourself, to notice and live inside the passing moments. Though the purely unself-conscious experiences open only to a child are behind you, you can get close. You are the same person who once knew the world so directly through your eyes and hands and feet, who felt so perfectly at home, and you can feel something like that again. Through the waves' constant churn and wash, a flock of grazing Shetland sheep heard me splashing along the muddy path and parted to let me run through. Redshanks piped out their songs and skimmed along the wave tops. I passed a flat patch of grass atop some rocks where Amy and I had picnicked in August while Anya'd spent one of her first days in her new school. Back at the cottage, after I'd taken a hot bath and while Amy and I were fixing dinner, she told me she'd teared up for a few minutes watching Anya fly the ladybug kite on Combo Sands. It really was just like I'd pictured it when I was pregnant, even before, when I used to think about having a kid. She stood at the stove while I chopped vegetables beside her. And still later, when Anya's teeth were brushed and she was in her pajamas, and we were playing one more round of the card game Sleeping Queens before bed, Amy mentioned how much she'd loved our kite-flying adventure. Anya paused before turning over the next card from the stack. She cocked her head and looked contemplatively away out of the corner of her eye. I could see her mulling over this new memory. The experience had already become another place she could always go in her mind. The ladybug kite swaying in the wind, the surprise and delight in her parents' voice. The circle she'd drawn in the sand and set inside had already taken their places inside the childhood, as she'll always know it. I wish we were still doing that, she said. Pocket Journal Entry, Marquette, Day 3 continues. February 4th. Mom was in bed for the night, and Aunt Charlene was lying beside her. Mom woke and opened her eyes. Charlene said, I love you. And Mom answered her little sister, I love you too, Charlene. Then she said her hands hurt. We brought her morphine. Sweet morphine. When Mom was asleep again, my own little sister Anne and I sat on the sofa looking at old pictures from our childhood and from before our childhood. Here were our cool mom and dad in a garage apartment in Irvine. Dad was reading Ulysses. For his graduation, Mom gave him the book along with Dr. Zhivago. Outside the door of the apartment, there were lawn chairs and an ashtray. I'd never before noticed how truly beautiful Mom was in these pictures. Early, when we were getting her into bed, preparing to transfer her so delicately, so carefully from her wheelchair, using a contraption that looks like an engine hoist, I'd thought I'd done everything right, slowly, gingerly getting her strapped in the harness, but I'd forgotten about her wheelchair seatbelt. Like the transfer hoist, the seatbelt is a recent necessity. Even sliced and sliced again from her extremities inward, she's managed to stay relatively mobile with just the help of my dad. But when she declined the amputation of her hands and called an end to the dialysis, hospice came to the house with a thing she would need now, the little bottle of morphine with the eyedropper-like squeeze tube for under her tongue, the lift, a hospital bed for the living room. She's declined the use of the hospital bed, thank goodness, and kept that last realm of independent life, her own bed. But as we were cranking the hoist to lift her from her wheelchair and put her there, she gave a small moan. Most movements hurt her at least a little, but Mom has a tolerance for pain unlike anything I've ever seen. This was something even more than the usual ache. The seatbelt. It had been hidden under a pillow on her lap. I lowered the hoist and Dad unbuckled her. When that was over, and we had her up and swinging slowly, suspended from chair to bed, she opened her eyes and looked at me. "How you doing, Ma?" Her pupils were tiny in their seas of green iris. "How you doing with all this?" She looked at me with, "Please hear me out there," on her face, and said, "Weird."
That brings us to the end of tonight's episode of The Desk on the Sea, written and read by Jonathan Johnson. Thank you for listening. Join us next time to continue Jonathan's story. Music for this episode is by Caerdwin and Greg Spatz. I'm Ben Reed.